Welcome to the Dive Podcast, presented by Willamette Week, where every Saturday we discuss the biggest news stories of the week with Portland's noisiest newsmakers, savviest culturistas, and some of the best journalists in the game. I'm your host, Brianna Wheeler, and I want to hear from you. So send your questions and comments to me, bwheeler@wweek.com. All right, y'all, enjoy the show.
Oregon versus Portland seems to be the theme of this year's election season. Rural communities resent how Portland has represented the state at large, and Portland is obviously struggling with its own systems of governance. Still, any politician platforming on returning Oregon to anything resembling an Oregon of yore is not campaigning to me. Not me, a queer-parented, biracial mother of a disabled son. And they're not campaigning to any of my friends either, or my contemporaries, or basically anyone who isn't old, rich, and white. Okay. All right. No, I'm sorry. That's unfair. I know that there is a huge segment of the population that does remember a more idyllic Oregon than someone in my shoes ever really could. And they're not all rich or old. I want safety and security and opportunity too. But not at the sake of the environment that I live in, or the safety of my children. And my rights certainly shouldn't feel contingent on the whims of those with deeper pockets than my own. That's a universal feeling, right? Historically, Oregon is a city-state. That means the majority of the voting power lies in our very liberal-leaning cities, rather than the more conservative counties statewide. Now, this is what makes Betsy Johnson's candidacy for governor so divisive. She has the resume of a mostly party-line-toeing Democratic stateswoman, and she's a textbook illustration of a 1% boomer, a white West Coaster who served on the board of Planned Parenthood but balked at the state's minimum wage hike, a political elder who trades exclusively in privileged circles while keeping herself firmly headquartered among the rural electorate. On this week's episode of The Dive, we'll discuss what her candidacy says about the state of Oregon. It's Saturday, September 2nd, and this is episode 87 of The Dive. This week's cover story is Nigel Jaquess' profile of Betsy Johnson, the independent candidate for governor whose CV includes timber heiress and helicopter fleet owner. Doesn't that make you feel represented? That's so relatable, right? Esteemed WW News editor Aaron Mesh will join me to break down Nigel's piece while Nigel is away. But first, here are a few of my takeaways from this week's edition of Willamette Week. It's choose your team time in City Hall as city leadership chooses sides on charter reform. In favor are Senators Akasha Lawrence Spence, Casey Jama, and State Reps Maxine Dexter and Can Pham. Predictably, Dan Ryan and Mingus Maps will vote no, but Maps says he's got an alternative cooking that should be ready by fall. Charter reform would radically restructure our city's government. So, you know, just make sure to consider the efficacy of our current government when you're voting. Sophie Peel reports that hundreds of city workers are refusing to return to their downtown offices, and how their arguments as to why might be a little bit tone deaf, especially in the faces of frontline city hall workers like janitors, case investigators, health workers, and other support staff at the Justice Center. Aaron and I will also chat about how the normalization of remote work stands to affect the labor movement on the whole. And you're probably going to hear my kid in the background, because that's exactly what happens when hot moms in your area are working from home. Speaking of moms, how y'all handling your kids' first week of school? I see you. There's a boozy milkshake roundup in the back half of this week's paper, so what's up? Y'all ready to get just absolutely ice cream hammered this weekend, or what? Holler at me. All right, now let's catch up with Aaron Mesh to discuss Betsy Johnson and the complexities of a divided Oregon. What is so polarizing about Betsy Johnson running for governor?
I think it has something to do with the urban-rural divide in the state of Oregon. I think it has to do with the fact that most Portlanders define themselves in ways that people who live roughly 30 miles outside the city find off-putting. And Betsy Johnson is attempting to bridge an increasingly polarized electorate by being someone who appeals both to the sensibilities of someone living in St. Helens and someone living in Tualatin, Troutdale. And I think that that's actually a difficult thing to broach because of the degree to which these two groups are polarized at this point.
So Betsy Johnson has worked in the public sector for several many years. What accomplishments did she make while she was working in the public sector?
So Betsy Johnson's career spans 20 years in public service. Before that, she founded and ran a helicopter company. Her helicopters actually ferried journalists and scientists to the Mount St. Helens eruption in 1980, which I just think is a charming detail from Nigel's story.
Yeah.
That when reporters who didn't have a TV station chopper, Betsy Johnson had a fleet of helicopters that could take people out there. Mm-hmm. So she began to get involved locally in her town of Scappoose, involving herself in campaigns for the library. She got into a battle with a gravel company over the future of Scappoose. And then when she got to the legislature, I think what Nigel's story shows that's striking is the degree to which she saw herself as an advocate for her constituents, someone who was going to not only pass laws in the legislature that would make things easier for people who lived in her district, but also would go to state agencies if she felt the government was overreaching and advocate on behalf of people in her district saying, back off. She kind of has a guard dog quality in that way of saying she certainly is someone who's pugnacious and is not unhappy in a fight. And I think that a lot of people who live in her district feel like they have an advocate or a champion.
Mm-hmm. It seems like Betsy's campaign is trying to invoke this kind of good old days rhetoric. We're trying to get Oregon back on track. What is this track that she's aiming for? What does it mean for Betsy Johnson to get Oregon back on track?
Well, I think there are two things that are happening at once here that are worth talking about. I mean, I don't think you can overstate the resentment that the majority of the state feels toward this city.
Mm.
And if I were campaigning for governor, hoping to win on anything other than the Democratic ticket, I would be campaigning hard against Portland right now.
Against Portland?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, Betsy Johnson got in a lot of trouble for calling Portland the city of roaches, which is not that funny as puns go, but, I suspect it resonated just fine outside the urban growth boundary. The problem for her is that there probably aren't enough votes out in the rest of the state to overcome the Portland metro area's advantage electorally.
Yeah.
But she's been betting since the day she announced her candidacy on the idea that most Portlanders feel a revulsion toward their own city. And I think she's overestimated that. I think that's probably not going to redound to her advantage.
Mm-hmm.
But, what does she mean by saying that she wants to bring Oregon back to what it was? I think that to some degree, everyone is uncomfortable right now with the pace of change and the ability of elected officials to be able to respond to that change.
Mm-hmm.
That no one is excited about the idea of Portland's murder rate skyrocketing and downtown essentially being a ghost town in which something like 70% of office space is vacant.
Yeah.
So there's no way that most Oregonians are happy with how the state is doing. I think when you read Nigel's story, to some degree what you see is that the vision that Johnson has shown for the state repeatedly is to do the bidding of the 1%. Of people who already have power, who already have assets, who already have means,
mm-hmm.
And to make sure that government doesn't make their lives any harder. And I do think that there's a real question that Nigel's story raises, which is, even if you agree that Oregon isn't working well right now, is the approach that Johnson has represented in Salem for 20 years, one that's going to benefit all Oregonians or just a few.
Yeah. Well said. I'm going to bounce over to that topic of city workers not wanting to return to their offices. So we normalize remote work. Everyone has demonstrated that they are perfectly capable of doing their work outside of an office. But that kind of feels like a battle won for people who work in offices. But now we're starting to see the trickle down from that. What is happening? How is that absence affecting the city?
Well, again, something like 70% of cubicles in the downtown core are sitting empty. And that leads to real questions about what the geography and placemaking of the city looks like. The entire urban plan of the city, dating back all the way to the opposition of the Mount Hood Freeway in the 1970s, has been on this idea that downtown is Portland's most important neighborhood. That it's the neighborhood in which everyone in the city is going to set foot on their way somewhere else over the course of the day. It's a beautiful vision, right? Yeah. Like the idea that you're going to ride the MAX train, you're going to stop in on downtown, you're going to stop by Pioneer Courthouse Square, maybe see a concert at lunch, and that on your way to and from your home in whatever neighborhood you live in. But you're essentially a resident of two neighborhoods when you live in the city of Portland. And that's not true in most U.S. cities. I remember growing up and spending a few months when I was a teenager in downtown Atlanta working a job. And downtown Atlanta after like 5 p.m. is dead. Like, and I don't mean like it's scary. I mean like it's dead. Like you can't find a living soul on the streets. It may have changed, but back when I was there, like it was essentially the only thing open after 6 p.m. was a little mall called Underground Atlanta. And even that was closed by like 8.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of having a downtown that is a second neighborhood that everyone is a resident of, like they see it as much their neighborhood as their own neighborhood, whether it's Beaumont or Alberta or Sunnyside, I think that's really essential to what the city of Portland is. And so remote work has challenged a lot of norms nationwide. It was done for very obvious reasons. The spread of this virus.
Yeah.
And now it has actually, I think there's a shift. There's a vibe shift, as they say.
Yeah.
And that vibe shift is that people aren't asking to remain at work remotely because of fear of contracting COVID. People are asking to remain at work remotely, and this is both in the private and public sector, because they see it as essentially a condition of a good employer. That at least a hybrid model where you only have to set foot in the office 1 or 2 days a week is seen as essentially a baseline of it's going to become the new labor battle, the new workers' rights question going into Labor Day.
Yeah.
Is do I have the right not to come to the office?
Mm-hmm. The city in general employs lots of different types of people. And this portion represents just kind of a slim margin. How are these, the frontline workers, what's their reaction to the labor rights battle happening on the other side?
I'm glad you asked that question the way you asked it, because I think it's a really good framing for this, because I think it's going to be an increasing tension between so-called frontline workers, in other words, people who were not given the luxury of getting to go home at any point in the pandemic, and white-collar workers whose job can be done from their couch.
Yeah.
And I think that the rhetoric that city workers have used to describe why they don't want to come back to the office could potentially be pretty quickly alienating to people who work jobs that require them to be there in person because of the nature of the work.
Mm-hmm.
But, going back to Sophie's story that she published this week on city workers responding very negatively to the idea of being asked to come back to the office 5 days a week or even 3 days a week. The language that was used was that such a policy would be racist, would be ableist, would be sexist.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of readers responded to that by rolling their eyes. I do think there's some validity in that, especially around working moms who have finally have the ability to balance work and life in a way that isn't possible when you're at the office. Mm-hmm. So this has the requirement to return to the office could indeed be seen as violating rights in some ways. But if I were working as a park ranger for the past 2 years, and I heard that people who are making triple my salary, who sit at a desk, think that they're too good to show up 2 days a week at work, I would not be feeling a lot of labor solidarity.
Yeah.
And also, if they start saying that that's racist and sexist to make them show up 2 days a week to have a meeting, I too would not be feeling particularly arm in arm with my labor brothers and sisters, were I someone who works a job that requires me to sweat and breathe in other people.
Yes. And deal with sexism, and deal with racism, and deal with ableism from more people than just a middle manager or an upper manager.
Also, you have to ask the question, of course, to what degree are those concerns about sexism, racism, ableism, etc., being offered in good faith?
Yeah.
There's a very interesting moment in Sophie's story in which a black woman working for the city says, in response during a forum, do not tell me what my experience was like in order to make a political point about wanting to stay home. In other words, that there are plenty of people who are having different experiences. It's not monolithic.
Of course.
And that there is at least some suspicion among the workers themselves that that people are using whatever language they feel is most politically advantageous in order to get what they want.
Yeah. So as we approach election season, can you give us a preview of what kind of coverage we can expect from the WW newsroom?
I think that one of the questions we're going to be spending a lot of time thinking about is, in a city that's shifting as rapidly as Portland is, what values and expectations should we have for our leadership that they're going to be able to create some kind of stabilization for this city?
Mm-hmm.
I think that that Tina Kotek, Betsy Johnson, and Christine Drazen each have a case to make in the next 3 months about what has gone wrong in this state and how they're going to fix it. And our job as a newsroom is to examine those claims and try to compare them against what we're actually seeing in day-to-day life in this state. I think both this Betsy Johnson profile that Nigel's written, this investigative examination of her record, and Sophie's story on the reluctance of workers to return to downtown Portland, both preview the struggle for this state that's going to be happening over the next 3 months, in that both capital and labor are going to see what happens in the next 3 months as an example of the selfishness of their opponents. That I think that if you are a public employee, union member, Democrat, as many voters are,
mm-hmm.
And you look at Betsy Johnson, you see someone who carries water for rich men when they get in trouble because they've done terrible things to the environment of this state.
Yeah.
And I think that a lot of what we've seen in the pandemic generally is people looking out for their own interests and beginning to feel alienated from the interests of others. And so I think what you'll see in the advertising of this campaign and what our newsroom will have to examine and try to distinguish what's true and what's not is essentially arguments from the three candidates for governor that their opponents are betraying the majority of Oregonians for the selfish interests of the few. So that's a lot to think about for voters and a lot to think about for a newsroom.
My gosh. Is there any candidate that's just, I'm just here for the people? I mean, they all say that, but
if they were good people, why would they be in politics? You're going to get in trouble for that one, which is why you should definitely air it.
big thanks to this week's guest, WW News editor himself, Aaron Mesh. And thank you for joining me. I hope you'll join me again next week. Until then,